we're reminded that anthracite is a product of a movement in the Earth's crust. The lateral pressure generated by a thrust against a geosyncline transformed bituminous coal into anthracite by driving off water and volatile matter. The highest rank of coal, anthracite, contains 91 to 98% fixed carbon. The high fixed carbon content gives anthracite its gem-like characteristics. It is hard, jet black in color. Some is iridescent and can be polished to sheen. It has been converted into jewelry and carved into works of art. Indeed, one of its etymological roots carries the meaning precious stone. The true value of anthracite, however, is measured by its ability to burn, not by its aesthetic properties. The high fixed carbon content makes anthracite difficult to ignite. It must reach a temperature of 900 degrees Fahrenheit before it will begin burning, while bituminous coal's ignition temperature ranges between 700 and 800 degrees Fahrenheit. But once ignited, anthracite requires only a natural draft to provide an even and intense heat. Nearly all of the commercially exploitable deposits of anthracite are found in a small area of Pennsylvania. The region can be enclosed by a line drawn from Forest City on the Lackawaxen, south to Dauphin on the Susquehanna, east to Jim Thorpe, and back to Forest City. A series of ridges and valleys trending from the northeast to the southwest structures the 1,300 square mile area. Words of Harold Orund in his study, Coal Cracker Culture, Work and Values in Pennsylvania Anthracite, 1835 to 1935. Professor Orund begins his study with geology, then moves to geography, and, setting the stage in this way, he will move on to the people of the region and their values. As an artist, Dennis Janoschot grew up in this area, and he began with the people. He was fascinated with faces, and they became the focus of his work early on. He expanded from painting to sculpture, and here is where geology enters. He came to work with stone and marble as the years went on. And in his most recent body of work, it is geology, geography, and people and their values that have coalesced in an exhibition titled Anthracite, ANTHRA-SIGHT, that will open at the University of Scranton's Hope Horn Gallery on Friday, September 8th, with a gallery talk and reception. Dennis Janoschot is an award-winning artist and teacher. He paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about the exhibition Anthracite and how his art developed.
I'm an identical twin, and I have a twin brother, David. And growing up, both of us had the same interests. And we did do a little scribbling on the walls. I guess most kids do at that age when you're very young. And we both grew up and we started getting works in shows such as the Scholastic shows and everything. During grade school, it started with my brother. I wasn't in anything in the grade school then. But as we got to junior high and everything, then we started getting really interested in the art. And then we started realizing in high school that we were either going to major in art, phys ed. Music was one of the considerations, but music or art were the main ones.
Were you working with many different media at that point?
Well, you know, when you start in high school, you're mostly drawing and painting. You're not doing a lot of involved things such as working with bronze or anything. You start doing that when you get more to college. And when I got to college, I found out that I really liked to paint, and I was influenced by a painter by the name of Chuck Close, and he worked with the airbrush. So I, myself and my brother worked with the airbrush, and we started doing these really large portraits of people's faces, like Chuck Close did. They weren't 8 feet by 10 feet like his, but they were 3 feet by 5 feet, and then they developed into 4 feet by 4 feet. And we had quite a few shows in the area showcasing our airbrush work on Masonite.
And you also then took some education credits.
Yes, we wanted to be teachers.
And this place has had a great impact on your lives, where you grew up, in fact.
Yes, you know, Erica, ever since I can remember, there were always stories floating around about the mines, you know. As a matter of fact, in the little house that I grew up in North Scranton, near the Marvin Colliery, which I've gotten a lot of materials from for this show, there was a big crack in the cellar floor, and my mother told me when she was a little girl. Now, when I was growing up, it was already waning. The industry was waning in the 60s. But when she was a little girl, she told us, my brother and I, that you could actually hear them drilling and working in the mines. It was coming up through the crack in the floor. It's sort of scary because, you know, how far down were they? You know, there were a lot of cave-ins in the city, but I don't believe that area ever caved in.
So right from an early age, it was in your imagination.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't only my imagination. My neighbor worked at the Marvin Colliery, and we would watch him walk to work in the morning and come back in the evening. And we could actually hear the breaker, you know. And this was already, I think the production was slowing down. I don't even know if they were actually digging coal when I was growing up. But they were getting it for market, and they were sizing it and breaking it down to get it ready for market. I think that's mostly what the Marvin Colliery did when I was a child. But there were still people working at the breakers.
Did you sneak over? Did you play?
Oh, Erica, when my brother and I were little kids, that was like our little exploration. We loved to go over and check out all the comb dumps. We used to go looking for fossils when we were little kids.
Did you find any?
Yeah, beautiful fern, mostly ferns, bark from trees. They were right across Leggett's Creek where I lived in North Scranton. We used to go over there all the time. And then we'd also go over to the mines and explore the buildings that were mostly deserted. That was the fun part, but a little scary. Probably wasn't legal either. But we were little kids. We were adventurous.
And what about the color palette? Because we always talk about Franz Kline, right?
Yeah, when he used mostly black colors, black, very graphic images on the canvas.
Did you have a sense about the blackness?
Well, when I started doing the work for this particular body of work for anthracite, I was conscious of black. And, you know, I was actually using coal silt, which is black, from the Marvin Colliery. I would go and collect it. I would process it. I would filter it, screen it through screens, and get it ready, and mix it with other additives to make it stick to the surfaces I was using. So, yeah, I was concerned with black. I did have to use some black acrylic paint. I did use regular artist materials also, but I tried to keep true to using materials from the anthracite industry.
So what was the spur for this show then?
Growing up right in this area in Scranton, I felt compelled to try to carry on the memory of what actually happened here. Because, you know, Erica, I am a teacher, and a lot of the students I have nowadays, they know nothing about the coal mines. And I wanted to try to create a body of work that reflected what I thought, my own vision of what the coal mines were like and the people and the culture of that time. And I wanted to hopefully convey that message to students and other people that aren't familiar with it. So that was my impetus, the main impetus behind doing this whole body of work for anthracite.
As you suggest to us then, you wanted to use the very materials.
Yes, yes. You know, it was so strange going back to these places, because I live in Green Ridge now, but going back to these places that I haunted as a child, it was really interesting to see how they've changed. Some of the places weren't even there anymore. But I used materials from those places and I collected them. And it was really interesting going back to those places.
What kinds of things then did you find?
Well, I remember as a kid, and in one of the pieces in the show is called Fire Within. And what it is, it's a gigantic comb dump that was burning. And I remember the Marvin had two comb dumps that were burning in between Alphen Avenue and Boulevard Avenue. And at night, as a child, I remember going up Route 81 and seeing this beautiful blue glow on that mountain. It looked like someone put Christmas lights on the mountain, and it was a beautiful blue glow. And this piece that I did called The Fire Within, I have blue LED lights inside of it, and I actually use the materials from the burnt comb dumps, the red ash and the cinders and all, and I mixed them together with them. I combined them with the binder, and I connected them all together and made this mountain as I remembered it as a child.
How big is that?
I'd say it's probably around maybe 48 inches or more wide, maybe around 25 inches deep.
Now, you talk to us about scale here. You have some very big pieces.
Yes, I do. A few of them, boy, not easy getting them around. And in the gallery, you know, we had to go up four flights. And unfortunately, as I had them crated, they would not fit in the elevator. Thank God my twin brother David was there to help me. He always helps me with my art shows when I have to move all these heavy objects. I work a lot with stone also. And whenever I have a show, he always helps me. But Erica, we had to climb up four flights, four stories to get to the Hophorn Gallery. And they were heavy. They're very heavy because there's coal on them. and there's a lot of other materials.
Well, describe this one for us so people who can't see this image.
This one piece is called December 9th, 1914. And the reason I named it that is because there was a colliery, there was a mine company in North Scranton. It would have been along where you would get on the expressway, the North Scranton Expressway from Main Avenue, and it would go toward town. Right now, Scranton High School is down there. And up on that little hill going toward Tripp Park, up on the hill, they were situated right on that hill. On December 9th, 1914, there was a bad accident in breaker number one. They had two breakers. And in breaker number one, all the miners, it was early in the morning, they were loading into this cage. It's basically an elevator that would take them down into the mines. And as they were going down, as it started to lower them, the whole right side of the cage just broke. There were 14 guys, miners, going down to work that day. And 13 of them died. One was able to hold on the side that did not break, and he lived. And the 13 other fellows just fell to their deaths. And, you know, Erica, it was not pretty. And this show that I have is not flowers and pretty things, but I hope them to be very powerful enough to convey the ideas of how culture and life was during the anthracite, the reign of King Coal. And when these guys ricocheted down, it said, I read in the Scranton Republican that it was very hard to identify the bodies. They were so badly mangled. So one guy did live, and he couldn't even give an interview that same day because he was so shaken up by it. And the funny thing is the coal company, which was the Lackawanna Coal Company, and they tried to say that one of the miners had a stick of dynamite in his pocket and that it blew up, and that's what made the cage blow apart. You know, in those days, OSHA did not exist. And there were no laws that said you had to inspect things on a regular basis. They were just interested in grinding out and getting the coal, bringing it up and making their money. They didn't really care too much about the individuals mining the coal itself. You know, when I did this particular piece, I made it 8 feet high because I had to give the idea that there is a shaft there and there was some height. And I do have, if I can describe it, I have the one boot at the top. And there's a 45-degree angle. That represents the bottom of that cage that broke. And then I have some of the wood down near the bottom, along with some faces of the miners and their tools as they fell into the sump below. And that was 250 to 300 feet they fell to their deaths.
What's the material of the faces?
The material of the faces is plaster. And it's made from an auger solution that my brother and I made. And you can get really fine detail with it. If you look at the faces on all the pieces that I have in this show, I've used a lot of those faces for different pieces. And you can actually see the pores of the skin, the lines of the lips. They're really realistic looking.
So we get a real sense that these were
living.
Yeah,
and they're life size. They are life size. So if you look at that picture, I know the people can't see it, you know, on the radio, but if they come to the show, they'll see it. And as soon as they walk in the gallery, they will notice it. And they are really realistic looking.
And that's fascinating because you and your brother began by making faces in your work and your original shows.
Yes, we're always sort of interested in representation and you know, in portraying things as they really were. But that's the way most people start doing art, especially when they're in grade school and high school and going through college. They start very representational, and then they start getting a little more abstract. I have a combination of abstract and representational pieces in this particular exhibit. And, you know, the reason I call it anthracite, it's not anthracite spelled as anthracite would be spelled. It's anthra-sight, because these are anthracites that I tried to create to portray the stories that I've heard and the research that I've done.
Yes.
I have some very small pieces, too, and a lot of these are made with the pure byproducts of the industry, stuff that I've gotten from the Marvin Colliery site. And I like to call them, they're almost like doing a mosaic, because on some of the pieces, most of the pieces, all of the pieces really, I did not just slap a lot of coal on there. I had to place them in carefully according to their size and according to what colors I wanted if I was using the culm ash. Because all that really is, Erica, all those colors you see on those culm dumps that we see now, they're basically iron oxides, and they have beautiful hues of red, yellow, orange, and lavender. So I would take these, and I figured if I can organize these colors, I could create little mosaic-type reliefs, and that's exactly what I've done.
Now, you, in your statement about the show, remind us about the things that were so dangerous, not just the breaking of the cage, but also the gases.
Yes, yes. That was a very dangerous phenomenon. And, you know, Erica, when they start digging the mines out and the air gets in there and it's exposed to that coal, it sort of breathes it in, sort of like we breathe the air in. It creates air that you cannot breathe. It creates gases that humans or animals cannot live by breathing. And the scary thing is you won't even know that you're in that situation. And it could happen in a matter of seconds. That's why when a lot of kids would want to go into the mines, I hear stories of people wanting to go. You have to be very careful because there aren't vents pumping that air out. No fans pumping that air out. And if you're in lampblack, you're going to die. No one should go down to the mines, especially abandoned mines.
And there used to be little fellas who were employed to open
yes,
the doors.
Yes, the nippers. And there's a piece in my show called Nip Going Home. And it's a little guy, and he's on a cart. And these nippers would sit behind the doors, and they would control the airflow and the fresh air that would go in and out of the areas where the miners were working. So these little nippers would sit on these little benches for sometimes 12 to 16 hours a day. And you know what? They made 11 cents an hour. I know it was back in the 1800s and the turn of the century, but still, these poor little kids, they had to sit there and wait. And when the coal cars would come down through the door, they would have to open the door. You know, there was a slope. They would coast out a lot of times. And they had these guys called spraggers and drivers. And they would drive these carts down through the mines. And the nipper would have to open the door. And if they didn't slow down those cars properly, sometimes it would break down the door and the nipper would get killed. You know, so the nip that I have in this show is Nip going home. And he's on a cart and he is not alive. And I did not know this. My father never told me this, but my aunt told me that my father was a nipper in the mines. His parents died of the influenza, and my father had to go to work in the mines so the families could have bread on the table to live. So he never told us that because, I don't know, if you don't want to talk about it.
So talk to us then about what's going to happen on Friday.
Yes, on Friday, September 8th, the whole shebang will begin with, I'm going to give a lecture, really a lecture presentation about the work that I produce for the show. I have a lot of photographs, old photographs, to describe the situations and the sculptures that I made, along with video and music. So it's really a multimedia experience. I'm not just going to talk. So it should be quite interesting, and I'm hoping a lot of people will come to hear that. And that will be in room 228 of Brennan Hall. That's at the University of Scranton. That's on Madison Avenue. And that will be from 5 to 6. And then from 6 to 8, you could walk down the street to Jefferson and Linden. And in Highland Hall on the fourth floor is the Hope Horn Gallery. And that's where the exhibition is.
You've worked on it for more than a year,
yes.
Right? How did this deepen your experience of the region?
You know, as I did research, I started realizing that if it weren't for anthracite coal, the Industrial Revolution couldn't have been what it was. Deep mined, hard, long, and clean burning anthracite fueled the Industrial Revolution. If you think about it, Erica, every train locomotive ran on it. Every factory that used steam to run their machinery ran on it. Every home and every business used it for their heat. It was an important ingredient in the Industrial Revolution. Without it, America may not have become as great as it did.
Now, with regard to your own work, how has this project affected the direction you might be taking now?
You know, it's very interesting because, you know, working with these varied materials most people would call waste, I find that I work a lot with marble, and I find that I might start combining these materials with some of my marble work. So you never know what direction you're going to go when you're doing your art. But no matter what you do when you're working on it, you get more ideas while you're working on the art itself. And using all these different materials, like I said, the colors in that burnt comb, those beautiful hues can be used anywhere. So, I probably will be combining coal and comb ash and all those other ingredients with the art I do in the future. Who knows? We'll see what happens. It's fun experimenting with this stuff, seeing what will work and what will not work.
And you had some things that didn't come out, right?
Yeah, some things didn't. I try to calculate. I want to make sure that whatever I make is going to withstand time and be strong. I don't want anything that's going to be too delicate or break. So I had to find binders and experiment with construction adhesives, glues, all different types. and combine them to make sure that for whatever purpose I needed to put maybe a hunk of coal on one part of the surface, I want to make sure that wasn't going to come loose. I've experimented with tar. I've experimented with roof repair, blackjack, they call it. And I found that the blackjack, it's okay if it's a surface that isn't too steep or the objects aren't too heavy. It will hold them. But if the pieces are too big, they can droop when it gets warmer and they can fall off. So I had to substitute different types of materials to make sure that was going to hold.
So this was really an exploration.
Yeah, I think anytime an artist does art, they're always exploring. And I'm really exploring with materials. And a lot of artists are doing that today. Anything can be used as a medium today.
It seems like the Hope Horn Gallery will be a great space for this show.
It really is, yeah. And like, I mean, when you walk into the gallery, the way it's set up, there is a partition. So the two largest pieces are at the far end of the gallery, and you don't see them as soon as you come in. But when you walk on either side of that partition, that's when they're going to hit you like a ton of coal.
Dennis Januszak, an award-winning artist and teacher, speaking to us about his work and an upcoming exhibition titled Anthracite, ANTHRA-SIGHT, a sculptural narrative of the anthracite industry of northeastern Pennsylvania. The opening will be Friday, September 8th, with a gallery lecture at 5 at Brennan Hall, and that's at the University of Scranton, and then a reception that is free and open to the public at the Hope Horn Gallery, Highland Hall, 4th floor at the university, from 6 to 8 p.m. This is Anthracite at the Hope Horn Gallery at the University of Scranton, September 8th through October 6th. For more information on the web, scranton.edu, and to see his work, you may check Dennis Januszak's own website, sculpturejanuszak.net, sculpturejanuszak.net, and his last name is spelled Y-A-N-A-S-H-O-T, and Dennis has just one N, D-E-N-I-S, so it's Dennis Januszak, that's his name, and his website is sculpturejanuszak.net, and his exhibition is titled Anthracite, and that will open at the Hope Horn Gallery at the University of Scranton, Friday, September 8th, with a reception from 6 to 8, open to the public at the gallery itself, and that will be preceded by a gallery lecture, multimedia presentation by Dennis Januszak, and that will be in Brennan Hall, room 228 at the University of Scranton. That gets underway at 5 o'clock. For more information, on the web, scranton.edu, scranton.edu.